Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Dissident Film Club. My name is Keaton Weiss here with Justin Van Voris.
I was going to think of a great Hamilton lyric to come in with, but I couldn't think of anything at that moment.
Oh, sorry, you couldn't think of a great Hamilton lyric? There are a lot of lyrics in that play.
I know, just, you know, just an appropriate... appropriate lyric to go with my introduction, but I couldn't think of anything. So, that'll be my
So we're going to talk about Hamilton. We've been wanting to do this episode for a while because I guess it was released for July 4th on Disney Plus. And the only reason I have Disney Plus is because I have an unlimited Verizon account, and like one of the perks is you get a year free of Disney Plus. So I signed up for it and was able to watch Hamilton over the course of like 3 or 4 days. It took a while to do it because it's hard to find time when you have kids to watch a movie, and it's doubly hard to find time to watch a movie when your wife also wants to watch the movie, because I can't watch it without her. So now we have to find time where the two of us are free to watch it, which is doubly difficult.
I tell you, it's too complicated. Too complicated an existence.
Yeah, no, it is a complicated existence. Yes, for sure. Absolutely. No doubt about
that.
Plus,
the kids are more Sondheim fans.
Yeah, right. The kids wouldn't really appreciate it.
Hamilton, so this particular presentation was meant to go to theaters actually a year and a half from now. Disney bought it last year, I believe, because they filmed this back in 2016, 4 years ago.
Yeah.
And then, for the past 4 years, they've just been licensing out clips from it. Like, I saw clips from this movie a couple of years ago when there's Hamilton documentary came out on PBS. And so they were looking for the highest bidder to, you know, buy the whole thing and then release it at some point, assuming so in theaters. And Lin-Manuel Miranda already has a relationship with Disney, and last year they bought it. But the plan was going to release it in September of 2021 to theaters. But I guess movie theater shut down and Broadway shut down, they bumped it up to now, and that's how it found its way to. Disney Plus.
Yeah, so it, like I said, anybody could watch it. It's included, like I said, with the Disney Plus subscription. Obviously got a lot of viewers and kind of revived a conversation about Hamilton. One of the things about Hamilton, one of the things that makes it so successful is that, okay, so like 100 years ago, you know, in the 20s, 30s, 40s, really pre-rock and roll, musicals were basically where people would go to hear the kinds of music that they would listen to on the radio anyway, just integrated into a play, into a theatrical presentation. There was really no, like, show tune genre back then. Like the Irving Berlin musicals, right? Irving Berlin was writing songs for the charts at the time. He was also writing songs for Broadway. There was no show tune genre back then, basically. The kind of music that was in Broadway shows was more or less the kind of music that you would hear in public, either on the radio or at a nightclub or, you know, wherever. And then once kind of rock and roll happened, the sort of show tune genre emerged as sort of this novelty, because you still had Broadway shows kind of keeping alive this kind of music that was sort of going out of style as the years went on. And then you had what was called the rock opera. And that was like a special phenomenon within the Broadway world. And rock operas done well were extremely successful because they weren't presenting this sort of novelty genre of music from a bygone era. They were actually taking contemporary music of the day and putting them into Broadway shows, like Hair, right? You had these sort of psychedelic music of the 1960s that which people were into at the time. That came out in 1967, incorporating that very genre of music that was big at the time. And Hair was actually debuted at the Public Theater, the same theater that hosted Hamilton's off-Broadway run. Jesus Christ Superstar, 1970. Rent, 1996. That adopted, you know, that was very much like the sort of 90s alternative rock. It was, Rent's music is very much in keeping with that genre of music. And so when you do one of those plays well, it really takes off because you are basically incorporating music that people are already into, already listening to, and putting it in a Broadway show. And Hamilton is really the first successful rap opera. That's really what it is. You're taking a, you know, contemporary style of music that young people are listening to, and you're putting it on stage. And so when you do that well, it takes off. And Hamilton does that extraordinarily well. I don't know if you were expecting me to be so this sort of like contrarian about this and come on here and shit all over Hamilton. And, you know, we could talk about like
kind of.
Yeah, I bet so.
Well, because you're a very just a contrarian person.
Yeah, right. I mean, well,
if people really, really like something, I think you just don't like that.
Well, it makes me skeptical of it. Well, I'm also not a big fan of musicals. I'm just not a big fan of that genre. But I can objectively say
in high school.
What's that?
You were in a couple in high school.
Well, I was only in one. I was in Into the Woods. And the reason I wanted to do Into the Woods is actually specifically because there's not that much music in Into the Woods. And as a matter of fact, there's like a half an hour segment in that play where there's no music at all. And I think Into the Woods is a brilliant narrative. It's just a brilliant piece of theater. And I think Hamilton really works on that level as well. We could talk about like the political relevance of it. That's where I get to be a little more critical. Like, I don't think it is this cultural phenomenon that like Michelle Obama said it's the greatest piece of art she's ever seen in her life. And it makes sense that she would. I mean, it really is the Barack Obama of musicals in the sense that, like, it's extremely well written, it's extremely polished, it's extremely well executed, right? Everything about it is done very well, and it ultimately kind of means nothing. Like, it ultimately is just an excellent presentation. And Hamilton is an excellent presentation. I mean, I've done theater in my life, so have you. There's no taking that away from it. It really is a brilliant piece of theater. I don't know that it is worthy of being heralded as, like, one of the major works of art of the 20th century in terms of, like, its significance. Like, if like, people will be talking about this in 100 years. Like, I don't necessarily put it in that canon, but as a work of theater, it is brilliantly done. There's absolutely no question about that.
Well, I don't understand when people call something like Hamilton one of the greatest pieces of art they've ever seen. I don't know how I'm supposed to react to a great piece of art. Like, how do I know that I'm watching a great piece of art? How am I supposed to feel? Because because the tickets for Hamilton for like the back row are like $800 2 years from now. So I was expecting this, you know, you expect going in, this is going to be brilliant. And then, of course, you get cynical about it. How good can this actually possibly be? If people are talking, it's amazing, it's brilliant, it's the most brilliant thing I've ever seen, and they're shelling out hundreds and thousands of dollars for shitty seats to see this, how good can it possibly be? How good can something be? What am I supposed to feel when I watch something that has been hyped up that bad, that good? And so you watch it, and you know, you almost feel, wow, this is, when I sat down to watch it, I'm thinking, wow, this is actually pretty cool. I'm actually finally going to see. And a few of my friends have seen it. A few of my friends have won the Hamilton lottery, which I can't believe, which is if you win the Hamilton lottery, and I'm talking about in the normal sense of the world, not now, but you win two tickets for $10 each in the first two rows, and that's unbelievable. And so when I sat down to watch it a couple weeks ago, I'm thinking, wow, I'm going to finally find out what all the fuss is about Hamilton. Like, at the end of this, I might have, like, based on the hype, I might feel feelings that I've never felt before. And so, of course, I'm excited to know what that's like. And so you sit down and you watch it, and yeah, it's great. It's great. And maybe it's because I'm watching it on a TV, and maybe I'm not, in the
room.
The theater, watch it in the room where it happens. But It's great, but I you know, I don't know what I'm supposed to feel when people talk about you know, oh, I was blown away by it. I think that it's fantastic. These are the merits of Hamilton. It is an extremely well done musical. You know, you call it you say it's the first rap musical. I don't really see it as a rap musical. I see it as rap. Rap is just basically one aspect of the musicality of it, because you also have R&B, sure, and there are also a few more traditional show tunes in it. And but what I take away from it is, I mean, Lin-Manuel Miranda, I mean, he really is a genius. You watch it and you think, how could one human being think of all this stuff and take these real life historical events and take lyrics and then take rhymes and music and kind of put them all together? And then some songs also are like made up of pieces of other songs and other arrangements and stuff like that, all about this, you know, this historical event and this specific historical event, because, you know, it's a founding father that up until now has not been talked that much about. And you think, wow, that is really impressive for this guy to put all that together. And so that's what blew me away, is that, you know, the writing of it, the music of it. I've always been a fan of the music, because I listened to the soundtrack since it's been out. But, you know, is it, to get back to where I started, is it an amazing piece of art that, you know, really, you know, blows me away? No. it's good. It's great.
Right.
It's great, but it's going to take a lot more.
Yeah, a lot more. First of all, I don't think, like, the subject matter is that transcendent. I mean, that's one of the things that kind of keeps it from being, like, in this canon of just, like, amazing art.
Because, you know, it's Hamilton. That's the thing, is that, like, Hamilton is not a figure that, like, a Martin Luther King, a John Kennedy, a Lincoln. Hamilton invented the United States banking system.
Right.
You know, it's not like, you know, we should be really thinking about Hamilton. It's an interesting story, and how it culminates in this duel, which is a very profound thing.
No, it's a story about how this immigrant son of a whore came to the United States with nothing, and because he was particularly talented and particularly smart and particularly driven, became a very powerful neoliberal machine politics shitbag. That's really what it is. And that's the Barack Obama story, basically, you know, more or less, right? Minus certain parts, right? And so that's what it is. And that's why the sort of liberal class is so in love with it, because it really is an affirmation of their worldview couched in this sort of, like, diversity worship that they're known for as well, right? We're going to cast black and brown people as the founding fathers and tell this feel-good story about the founding of the country and how anything is possible here, right? So, like, in terms of that, it's all, like, very boilerplate, limousine, liberal, theater-going crowd. That's the genius of this on a marketing level. You could not have crafted something that is better suited to the theater community than this. Because in New York City, the theater-going audience are people who can A, afford to plunk down hundreds of dollars for a seat, right? And B, these, like, you know, cosmopolitan liberals who just get off on this stuff. And so I think in terms of the subject matter, that's where the limitations come in. But I do want to talk a little bit more about the execution of it, because the execution of it is phenomenal. But let me, don't worry.
Shut up. The immigrant aspect of it, well, I really like that. I mean, the slogan of the play is an American story told by Americans now. The musical reflects the world as it is now, which is there's many more immigrants now. The people in the musical make up a larger, much larger population of the population of this country than they once did.
Brilliant.
But you don't think that's interesting, that instead of having another, first of all, and also,
instead of having white people play Jefferson and Hamilton in Washington,
it's 1776 again.
It's not transcendent.
Also, let me tell you something. Like
it's good marketing to the New York theater scene. This has been done. Like, Shakespeare plays have been adapted to modern times, right? You do these sort of, like, anachronistic adaptations, right? So it's not like that part of it is anything that groundbreaking.
Yeah, but here's the thing. And this is where I'm going to get a little reverse racism going on here. Is that I don't know Lin-Manuel Miranda, what, you know, this musical is based on his tool set of what, where his talents lie, which is this type of music. You really think that if you're going to do a musical like this, you're going to cast a bunch of white guys to be doing R&B rap? It's going to be terrible. You think you're going to – I would not see a bunch of white people.
No, well, of course.
I'm not going to go see a bunch of white people rapping.
I'm not
it's
arguing.
It's going to be terrible.
I'm not arguing. I'm not saying he shouldn't have done it. I'm just saying that part of it to me is not what is genius. Like that part, that's something that has been done, right? We're going to tell this like traditional story in a non-traditional way.
But the Shakespeare stuff is what? Okay, Hamlet is a woman.
No,
you
well,
know,
like
Hamlet's
you saw,
a woman
like,
now. It's in modern day. No, this literally, it's confusing. You have a black person playing George Washington. You have a Puerto Rican, I assume, is what Lin-Manuel Miranda is, playing in America. It's, and these, I think there's like a few white people in like the dance crew, but the only person who is white
is
King George. And that's because that population, it's not the same as it is in the United States.
Well, I think it also represents a certain, like, I think what they might be going for is, like, a representing a certain, like, power dynamic. Like, the white character is the one who has power over the colonies at the beginning, right? And, you know, they mention slavery a bit in passing, you know, like, the ultra-woke people who are now upset that it doesn't deal with that enough. Like, I don't hold that against it at all.
I want to talk about that a little bit. I think it's hilarious that now, because I guess this ties into the whole statue debate where we're talking about the, you know, taking down statues. I mean, this is particularly when it comes to the Confederates, but then also people are like, well, you know, George Washington owned slaves, you know, should we really be worshiping George Washington? But when it comes to Hamilton, I find it so funny that for 5 years now, you have had people walking down the streets of Manhattan with that fucking soundtrack blaring in their ears, listening to, you know, Wait For It and Nonstop and Not Gonna Throw Away My Shot and worshiping this music. It has become, you know, anthems for young people and everything. And suddenly now, and these are also the woke people. These are also the woke people who are against, obviously, those types of statues commemorating the lives of people who supposedly own slaves and stuff like that. And now suddenly, what are they going to do? They're going to not listen to Hamilton anymore, this musical that they love and become a phenomenon. They're going to tear down Hamilton over this thing. I think that's so funny and so ironic that all this whole time, while also criticizing the statues, which, by the way, I agree with, now, the whole time, they've been listening to a musical based on a slave
holder.
Well,
look, I mean, I think that is a function of a couple of different things. First of all, I think it's a function of just the very fact that now, because this is available on Disney Plus, people who don't have $600 to plunk down on a seat or $800 or $1,000 seat are able to see it and are able to react to it, right? And so you're going to get more diversity of feedback because you're diversifying the types of people who are able to see it. And by types of people, I don't mean, you know, races of people. I mean, like, people who earn less than $300,000 a year who all of a sudden can afford to watch this thing. Then there's also a function of the George Floyd protests, right? There's also a function of the fact that we're in a pandemic now where, like, this whole, like, celebration of the American dream and the American way is just striking more and more people as such utter bullshit, because people are embarrassed to live in this country now, as they should be. It's an embarrassing country to live in right now for a number of reasons, not the least of which the fact that, you know, we are so willing to institutionally just sacrifice human well-being for the market, right? For the American dream, for the types of people who have pursued the American dream and who have achieved this dream. Now we are all supposed to what? Send kids back to school so that we can go back to work rather than just pass a UBI that gets everybody through the next year until there's a vaccine where we can all go to work and go back to our lives safely, right? And pursue the American dream safely. It's an embarrassing country to live in right now. And so this happened to come out at a time when people are feeling particularly bad about the country they live in. And this sort of like feel good musical that sort of, you know, mythologizes the founding of the country in a very brilliant way. Like I said, I'm not taking anything away from the play, but that affects, I think, the way people react to it.
Well, yeah, I think also, it's for the fact that at the time Broadway is shut down and you have this musical that not a lot of people have the ability to go see. Because also remember is that it's not a thing of that people get to see this. People have heard it. Because the soundtrack has been out for years.
Right.
People know this musical. They already love it without having to see it. And so a lot of people already knew what this musical was all about. And now they, because this there's never any, there's no real dialogue in this musical. And so if you were listening to the soundtrack, you're basically listening to the entire
thing.
Yeah,
that's why I called it. Right, exactly. Okay, right.
And so people already knew this. And the people who like Hamilton have been interested in Hamilton, but have not seen Hamilton because of they can't afford to go see it, whether they are and not in New York or Chicago or one of the touring companies that go see it, or they just can't afford to pay the ticket to the show. It is, and so you have those people who already love it, already know what it's all about, and finally get to see it. Also at a time when Broadway is currently shut down, and that's part of the reason why, of course, it was moved up from its release next year. So I see it a little less cynically than you.
A little less cynically than that. Well, no, but I mean, I think that's part of like why now there is this like, you know, widespread. I don't want to say widespread, but there is a debate about like what the play really means, you know, and there have been like critiques of the play from that point of view. And I sympathize with that, not as a criticism of the play itself, but just as a criticism of just like what a cultural landmark this play supposedly is. But in terms of the execution of it, to do a rap musical, watching just the performance of these lyrics is incredible to watch, that this could be executed with such precision 8 times a week. It's a 2-hour, 40-minute play. And, you know, like rap as a genre of music, that's why, you know, there are like freestyle rap artists, right? Because it's a form of music that does rely on sort of improvisation. And to have it this brilliantly executed to the point where like some of these guys go a mile a minute when they rap, to be able to just get those words out the correct way every single time, it like in perfect rhythm, because you know a Broadway show, the rhythm has to be perfect because there's not just the singer, there's the orchestra pit has to be in line with the lyrics, and there's a light cue that has to be in line with the lyrics, and a set change, right? Like all these moving parts have to come together at once, which is hard enough in like a standard musical, like a Cole Porter thing. But when you're talking about rap and this sort of really fast-paced interplay of lyrics and dialogue and dancing and lights and sound and instruments, it's pretty amazing just the execution of it, that it happens as well as it does every single time. The other thing I love about this play, and, you know, this play did not debut on Broadway. It actually debuted at the Public Theater off-Broadway, as I mentioned earlier. It's pure theater. Like, this play is really a work of theater in the sense that, like, the old days of theater, right? The old days of, you know, back to Shakespeare, even back to ancient Greece, right? Theater was just actors and audience. And I still think it's true that, like, the best theater can be done with no set design, no wardrobe, and no props. And even though this is a Broadway show, Which, you know, with some set, there's like those like wooden rafters and staircases in the background. And of course, there's wardrobe because they have the budget for it. So like, why not? Right. It's not reliant on any of those like Broadway spectacle devices. It's just actors and an audience. Like certain sequences I'm thinking of, like the scene where he has the extramarital relationship with that woman in the red dress. Her name is not coming to me, but like he's sitting at his desk in his sort of study. There's no set to represent that. You know, they don't move in these fake walls and build a set like you would see in a lot of Broadway shows. No, he sits at the desk. She comes. She, you know, talks to him. He talks back to her. She says, you know, I'm lost. He stands up. They walk to the other side of the stage. Now, all of a sudden, they're in a completely different place with no set design, right? There's no set change. It's all a seamless. It's one scene. It's one conversation that takes place in like four different settings. In his room, out on the street where he sees her, out on the street in front of her place. Then she invites him to come up. He comes up, but they don't actually move, right? And then the like sexual encounter happens symbolically. It's all representative. It's all one thing with no help from any set design or any spectacle. And there's so many sequences like that. And that to me is what pure theater is. Like pure theater is being able to tell a story with just people and an audience. And as much as this is a huge deal, this play, it's a $1 billion musical, it's a smash hit, it's on Broadway, you think you're going to get this big spectacular production. And you really don't. You really get theater in its purest form, which is performers communicating a story to an audience. And it's just fantastic in that way. I mean, there are so many sequences like that. This was directed by Thomas Kail. Fantastic, fantastic directing job on this play. That really brings it to life in such a personal way where you don't feel like you're watching a Disney musical. Like, you know, Beauty and the Beast has all these elaborate sets where when it's raining outside, they have this great backdrop and you could see the water coming down and you hear the sound. This is none of that. This is like I said, this could be done. Obviously, the timing wouldn't make sense, but like you could do this in ancient Greece. You could do a play like this with no budget. This could be done in a black box theater. This could be done anywhere. It could be done in a park. Well, you don't need anything but the people involved in communicating the story to the audience.
Yeah, no, well, I think that's how they are able to do it at the public theater, because the public theater, have you been to the public theater? It's a series of theaters, but they're all much smaller than obviously the theater that they're at.
Yeah, I forget the name of the theater that this was at in the public. I saw a couple things at the public. I mean, that's just, first of all, there's a great book about the public theater that I have on my bookshelf right here. It's called Free for All, Joe Papp, The Public and the Greatest Theater Story Ever Told. I'm reading that on my bookshelf right across the fantastic book. It's a great New York institution. They do Shakespeare in the Park. And I saw a couple of things there. First of all, we saw a friend of ours. Didn't Andrew Matthews have a reading there that we went and saw once in one of like the lab spaces? And then there's another space that I saw. This really actually was quite terrible. Christopher Durang play at, which this probably was in that room. But yeah, no, I mean, it so benefits from the fact that it started off Broadway, because they needed to be able to do this with limited resources or at first. And it really paid off in a huge way.
Yeah, I saw a play called Kings there a couple of years ago, which was a political play. And I saw the Bob Dylan musical that was briefly on Broadway this year, and which is more like a play with music. But those are great series of theaters. Great place, great New York spot.
That's it? You have nothing else to say on the execution of it?
Oh, the execution. It was great. I mean, I think you all, you pretty much summed it up. I mean, what's good about the musical, and why part of the reason why that people have been taking to it, is because ultimately it is a way for young people to get interested in history. And obviously, it's once again, it's about the guy who invented the United States banking system, but which on the outset doesn't really, you know, seem that interesting. I remember in college, I took an American Congress class, and, you know, one of the assignments was, not that I did it, was we had to read the Federalist Papers, which, you know, the fact that, you know, a musical about the guy who wrote most of the Federalist Papers has become such a hit. Is that in itself, I think, is mind-blowing, because that's some really boring shit there.
Well, you know, it's funny. It's almost like The Great Gatsby, where, like, Nick Carraway, even though he's the narrator, right, and sort of the main character in the sense that, like, we experience the novel through his eyes, he is basically the least interesting character in the story. I feel like that's kind of the same thing with this. Like, Hamilton really is the least interesting character in the play. You know, it works because you know, he is sort of at the center of these events that are so much bigger than him. And, you know, like, the personal narrative is compelling. It gets very dramatically interesting in the second half of the play. And that's the other thing. It really spans basically his whole life, from fighting the revolution to coming home, you know, and trying to, you know, like I said, become this, like, political operative. It really spans all that time. But then the second half gets into his personal life with his marriage and the problems with his marriage and his relationship with his son. And it's done in a very dramatically compelling way. One other example of just brilliant choreography is the sequence where he meets his wife and the wife's sister has feelings for him. And that whole number was just brilliantly blocked and brilliantly choreographed. They had the rotating stage, which I didn't know that they had. I didn't know they could even do that at the Richard Rogers Theater, but maybe they put a new stage in for it, because they had that rotating stage, which really helped the cinematic quality of this, like, recording, too. It was really well shot by a local hero here in the Hudson Valley, Declan Quinn. Is the director of photography, whose wife owns a couple of coffee shops here in the Hudson Valley. So we all know Declan.
Brother of Aiden Quinn.
Yeah. It was a funny Declan Quinn story. The first time I ever saw Declan and met Declan was when he was videotaping a concert that my brother was giving at a coffee house in Cornwall. And my brother was somewhat of, like, a celebrity in high school. Like, he wrote his own songs. And he had, like, a following of, like, almost 100 people who, like, knew all of his songs and were, like, big fans of them. And they would come and they would see him play. And, you know, he would play, like, you know, coffee houses, because he was, like, 16, 17 years old. He didn't do bars or anything like that. So, you know, you'd go to, like, a coffee shop. And he packed this place out. It was, like, 60, 70 people at the coffee shop. And apparently Declan, whose wife owns the coffee shop, was going to video the concert, who I guess to use it as, like, you know, a promotional video for the coffee shop. And I didn't know who he was or for what purpose he was filming. I just thought this was a guy who wanted to film there. And it was super hot in the place because it was absolutely packed. And he's setting up, like, lights, like, he's going all out with, like, setting shit up. And I see this guy there, and to the point where, like, it's like 20 after 7, and, like, my brother was supposed to start playing at 7. Now it's getting to be 7:30, and this guy's, like, setting up all this shit. And my blood is boiling, because I'm like, it is hot as hell in here. It is packed. Who the fuck is this guy taking forever to set the shit up, and why is he even doing this? I'm like, you want to videotape the concert? Right, just put a camera in the back of the room and hit play. What the fuck? I'm almost like, can you hurry up? And then I found out that he was actually connected to the coffee shop, and that he was a famous, you know, not a famous, but a very successful DP. I mean, he
shot Leaving Las Vegas.
Yeah, Leaving Las Vegas. He shot a bunch of huge movies. He did, I think, like 5 or 6 Jonathan Demme projects. Huge stuff. And we were lucky that he was filming. But it struck me as very strange that he was taking so long to film my brother playing some songs.
Did you have a favorite song in Hamilton?
See, this is the other thing. Like, I totally acknowledge, like, just, like, the brilliance of it as a piece of theater. I think it's a brilliantly executed work of theatrical art. I really would not seek out any of this music on my own to listen to.
Really?
I don't really feel, like, compelled to listen to it again. Because the thing is, like, the music works with the play. It's not something I would listen to as just music on its own. To me, it's a sum of its parts thing. Like, it needs the actors, it needs the story. Not that it's bad. It's just not really my thing. I'm not into this genre of music. I'm not a huge rap fan. I have, you know, some rap on the iPod, but like, it's not my favorite genre of music. And I'm just not at all into show tunes or Broadway as a music genre. So it's hard for me to say like what my favorite number was. I would say my favorite number, not because of the music, but because of just the way it was done on the stage, would have to be that number that I just referenced, where he meets his wife for the first time and the sister is kind of half rooting for her sister to get with him because she wants her sister to be happy, but she also has feelings for him too. The way that was choreographed was just brilliant.
I think the thing with Broadway is that all songs in Broadway are reflective of whatever that moment is in the storyline. Obviously, all the stories are referencing something that's going on. And so, I mean, there's tons of stories, tons of songs that are great in the Broadway lexicon that are referencing what's the context of the story, but they can be, they're listenable on their own. And I think Hamilton, there's plenty. I mean, I think My Shot is great. That's a song that you can listen to walking down the street, and I have, or Nonstop, or Wait For It, or The Room Where It Happens, because that while they are talking about stuff that's in the story, there are things that can be gleaned from the intention of the songs that are universal and go beyond the story. And so I would definitely argue with it there. I think it's a great soundtrack. I've discovered more songs when I saw the actual musical and discovered what some of the context was. But on its own, I still think it's a very listenable soundtrack.
Yeah, I mean, I'm not giving you much of an argument, because I'm not saying it's bad or it's not worthy of listening to if you're into that kind of music. It happens to not do much for me.
Okay, what was your wife's favorite song?
I don't even know, actually. I mean, I know you like The Room Where It Happens. It's a good tune. It's a good tune.
Yeah, it's a good tune.
I mean, look, like, to me, like, to ask me that question, it's almost like, all right, like, so what's his name from Fleetwood Mac just died? Like, I'd be the first to acknowledge that Fleetwood Mac, my glasses.
Mick Fleetwood?
No.
What's his name? Leslie,
are you going to make me holding look this
hold, while we hold, look? Hold. I mean, we don't need to. We can talk about this, but.
Fleetwood Mac founder. Peter Green.
Lindsey Buckingham? Oh, Peter Green. I don't know him.
All right. Anyway, the point is,
who cares?
Fleetwood Mac, I'd be the first to acknowledge that, like, Fleetwood Mac was a great band. But it just doesn't do anything for me. Like, it's not that I don't like it or I don't respect it.
You don't like Landslide?
I'm not a big fan of Fleetwood Mac. I just
Go Your Own Way?
No, Go Your Own Way I don't like at all. No.
That one I really don't like.
Landslide is a good song. No, like I said, they're good. So I'm not taking anything away from them. I'm just saying it's not my thing.
The Chain?
The Who is the same thing. Like, The Who is a great band. Yeah. Not my thing. I'm not really moved by any of their music. So there is, you know, there's a lot of music out there that I respect and I admire and can admire for what it is that I'm not going to go out of my way to listen to. And I think put Hamilton soundtrack in that category.
Well, I mean, to be fair, you wouldn't listen to any show tunes, and a lot of these songs are clearly of the show tune ilk, so they just would not be in that little category on your iPod.
You know what show I actually do have a bit, and this is going to surprise you, but the show that I actually do have a bit of a soft spot for in terms of music is Hairspray. Some of the music from Hairspray is actually really catchy.
Yeah.
Baltimore is a fucking great song. What's it?
Stop the Beat.
Without Love is a great tune. I mean, those are some great tunes in that one.
That is definitely a surprise.
Yeah,
choice.
No, you would not take me for a Hairspray fan, but I actually do like quite a bit of the songs in Hairspray.
I thought you were gonna say something really obscure. So you know, they just brought back West Side Story very briefly. And I really wanted to go see it. And the first couple weeks of March, when there was a rumor, well, not such a rumor, it was here, when people were saying, people were not sure if they should come to New York because of the coronavirus. So Scott Rudin had a discount day where he was going to put all his produced musicals for $50 each to get people to go to the theater. Because at that point, the first 2 weeks of March, people were a little apprehensive because, you know, they thought maybe we would have a coronavirus problem. And so I was like, yes, West Side Story. I can see the new West Side Story. And on the day that those tickets went on sale, they shut down Broadway. And I really wanted to see that West Side Story is because, once again, they took an interesting approach to it. West Side Story is my favorite musical. They took an interesting approach to it where they contemporized the setting. It was a modern-day setting, but they kept the songs exactly the same. So if you watch the musical, you have, like, people that would be characterized as today's type of street hoods, yet they still have, like, this 1960s sounds of the actual original soundtrack, right, which didn't exactly gel with the more urban, realistic, grounded visual portrayal that they were that we have today that they were doing in that show. So sometimes these new reimaginings of older plays, sometimes they don't exactly work.
Yeah, I didn't see any of the reviews for that. The one play that I was going to have to find a way to go see is the American Buffalo revival.
Yeah. Who was good? Was that Sam Rockwell?
Yeah, it was going to be Lawrence Fishburne and Sam Rockwell. And, you know, that's one of my favorite plays. And Sam Rockwell is one of my favorite actors. And that role is so perfect for him. He would play the Teach character, which... Dustin Hoffman played in the movie, and I think Pacino played that role off Broadway at Circle in the Square way back then. But that would have been such a great show to see. I'm really upset that got canceled because of the virus.
I never saw the movie.
Oh, it's great. Oh, you should watch it. That's such a fantastic play. That's one of my favorites. Just like the dialogue in that is so snappy and it's so fun and it's so cool and tricky and complex. Great play. The other thing about Hamilton, I sort of talked about, like, just what a work of pure theater it is. And this gets into, like, real theater geek kind of stuff. But I love the bows. I love the curtain call. And that's how you know a real play. When they don't do this, like, thing where everybody clears to say, okay, so, like, there's the end of the play. The lights go down. And then when the lights come up, all the actors are where they were when the lights went down. And they hold hands and they walk to the front. And they take their group bow, and they gave Miranda, like, his own bow, where he just kind of steps out briefly and takes his bow. But it's not like this thing where they all clear the stage, and the chorus comes in, and they dance, and they sing, and they smile, and they wave, and then, the minor players come out, and then the major players come out, and then the star comes out, and they get a big round of applause, and they do this final dance number for you, and then they leave. Like, it doesn't do that. Like, when the play is over, the lights go down, they come up, they group bow and exit. That's how you know a real play. And so I love that they did that because there were, you know, I was expecting, you know, the whole thing where, like, you know, Aaron Burr comes out and smiles and dances and waves and, you know, and that didn't happen. And that's a real deal quality to me. I don't know. I liked that about it. And I also like that it goes out on this very, like, somber, sort of mellow note. There's not this big finale number that you would see in a Broadway musical. Like, it's not this big ensemble thing at the end where they, you know, do a reprise of the main theme of the play, which I was expecting. But again, what surprised me about the whole thing is just how pure a work of theater it is. And that, to me, is what makes it brilliant, because you're taking the oldest art form ever, and you are being so true to the fundamentals of that art form while making it modern in a way that is just so perfectly executed that, you know, it became this sort of phenomenon. And it's great. I don't have anything against it. You know, when it comes to talking about the, like, broader implications of the story and the themes, that's where you can get a little bit like, okay, Michelle Obama, no, this is not the greatest work of art you've ever that has come out in your lifetime.
But you also, but also the people that are touched by it are immigrants and people who are represented on stage and get to see themselves on stage doing really good quality work, doing something a little bit different. And so, having said that, some of them might not be able to afford to actually see the show, but you know, and we talked about the immigrant, what types of jobs a lot of the immigrant population have in this country are low paying jobs. And some of these types of people aren't going to be able to afford to see this show. And so the people who do get to see it are the types of people that you talked about.
Right. And that's the thing that,
so, and they're almost really more employing themselves, but believe me, there are still a lot of people out there who do really appreciate what's going on stage because they get to see themselves represented doing something a little bit different in a creative way. And also it's extremely, extremely good quality.
Okay. No, that's fine. And I say that with no sarcasm in my voice. I mean that, you know, if that's true, that's a great thing. It's funny though, because I did think that, you know, because I get offended, quite frankly, at like how fucking expensive it is to go and see these goddamn shows. And look, the reason it's expensive is because theater is really not a profitable thing. All these Broadway houses are nonprofit houses that are bankrolled by rich people. Most of these plays lose money. I mean, and it's obvious why. Like, the challenge of doing a Broadway show is you have to recreate the show every single night. It's not like filming a movie where once it's done and it's shot and it's edited, the actors could stay home and you just play the movie for people. This, you actually have to produce the thing every night in real time, and that involves, you know, dozens, if not hundreds, of people.
Also, isn't that because there's more celebrities doing Broadway now?
No, I mean, I don't think that's a major driver of it, because I think a lot of the real famous people who do these have, I mean, they take massive pay cuts. Like, they're not getting anywhere near what they would get in a movie. Like, they don't really do that for them.
I doubt Bruce Willis took a pay cut when he did Misery on Broadway a few years ago.
What's that?
I doubt Bruce Willis took a pay cut when he did.
Well, anybody who casts Bruce Willis in a play is just a fucking moron. I mean, that's just like, I blame them for that.
You probably thought it was an easy gig. He lays in bed the entire play.
Yeah, no. I mean, a guy who's just so uninterested in his craft as Bruce Willis, to cast him in a play, do you have to do 8 times a week? No, I mean, that's, you know, that's insane. But what was I going to say? Oh, yeah, because the sort of economics of theater are so challenging, I was almost like thinking, like, why wouldn't they do this? Because not only is there the challenge of creating these shows every night, but there's also the issue that these Broadway theaters are small. These Broadway theaters are not huge theaters. The largest Broadway theater house in the city is the Gershwin, which hosts Wicked, and I believe that's 1,900 seats. And so these are not huge spaces. And I almost thought, like, why not do this in a huge room? Why not, like, put this up for, like, a month or two at, like, Radio City Music Hall, where you get 6,000 people in there a night? This way you could charge a little less money because you're doing such volume. But then when I saw it, I'm like, no, this really wouldn't work in a big room. Like, it really is intimate in that way. Like, this could work. You could do this at a Black Box or, you know, or in a field somewhere. Like, you really couldn't do this on a huge stage.
Yeah, no. There's also a misconception about Broadway that you need to sit in the first row for the experience to be good. But Broadway theaters are actually, as you said, relatively small theaters, and you can get a perfectly good vantage point in the back row, which is much. This is, of course, coming from experience, because I'm a back row kind of buyer.
Yeah.
You get exactly it. It's absolutely fine. You do not need, you know, Keaton and I, many years ago, we saw the late great Philip Seymour Hoffman in a play called Death of a Salesman, and I was in the second row. Well, you were. Where
I
were
was
you
in the balcony.
Show?
I actually, because we got rush tickets to that, and so when you get rush tickets, they kind of put you where they can, where they have openings. So you got to sit in the third row, and because my wife and I were going, we had to take the pair of seats that was not only in the balcony, it was actually obstructed view. So like all the action that happened, like on the extreme stage left, we didn't even see. We just heard.
Yeah.
But we were not far from the stage.
Right. But, you know, when you're there, second row, yeah, it's cool to have the guys right there. You get to see them, you know, spitting all over the place. But you do not need to be in the second row. And the, once again, the theater, which is amazing, it used to be, I thought, an everyman kind of thing. That, you know, you just, like a movie, you'd be like, hey, you want to catch a matinee, you just go and just have a seat in the theater and watch the performance. Of watching Also, the people on stage are not, it's elite people watching, people who are not the elite. These are hustlers. These are people who are not paid that that much money.
Yeah, the minimum salary for a Broadway performer, I think, is like $1,500 to $1,600 a week.
It is almost like the jester in a king's court. You are watching the lower class perform for the higher class, the upper class, and people think, well, you need to sit in the first row because it's, you know, it's like the seats on the Titanic. You know, you have to be in the upper echelon right. of people. As I think Elaine once said in that Airplane episode, you know, our goals as a society should be one without classes. Right. And Broadway has become a classist thing because you have the people who can afford to sit up front, sitting up front, and believe you me, you don't need to sit up front. You can have a great, wonderful experience in the back row. Having said that, if anybody's got a couple, you know, tickets that for the first row, I wouldn't turn them down. Right, I wouldn't turn them down.
Well, you know, it's funny. I mean, you're right. I mean, like, generally speaking, there really are no bad seats. I went to saw Mary Poppins at the New Amsterdam, and that's a particularly old theater. And so the seats are super small, you know, because people were smaller 100 years ago. And sitting in the back of the top row, the back row of like the upper balcony for that is weird because I don't know what it is, but that theater, the seats are very small and the stairs are very, very steep. And like you really are watching the tops of the actors' heads because the angle is such that you're looking like straight down at them. And so that was a little bit awkward, but that's the only time. Other than that, I sit in the back row all the time. Once we sat in the back row of the top balcony. Once was a fantastic musical too. That's another piece of like just pure theater because it was one set on the bar, and it was great because the bar on the set was the theater bar too. So like before the show, the audience, if they wanted to go buy drinks, they would go onto the actual stage, and at intermission, same thing. And the way that show starts is so cool. There's no like dimming of the house lights and then the play starts. It's like the house lights are on, people are just kind of chatting, and then this guy comes out with a guitar, sits in a chair, and just starts strumming, and as he starts strumming, the house lights go down and the play just kind of starts. That was another really, really cool musical.
I just want to brush on one more thing before we finish up while we're kind of on this discussion of Broadway, is that I don't know if you've noticed, but not only is Broadway now much more elite, it is less a New York thing.
Oh, sure.
Because Broadway used to be a uniquely New York experience. Broadway was in a terrible neighborhood. You would only go to the Times Square area if you're seeing a show. Otherwise, I mean, you still avoid it. Smart people avoid Times Square like the plague. Okay, that was kind of an inappropriate joke to make, but about the plague and not going to Times Square. But anyways, because it was filled with porn and prostitutes and crime. But thanks to Disney, the Times Square has been totally changed. And now Broadway has become less a New York institution and more of a tourist institution. And not only are you seeing the elite watching these plays, but you're also seeing tourists.
Right.
And it's not a theater going crowd anymore. Going to Broadway.
Right.
You have a tourist crowd. I was watching a video one time, a clip from the original performance of Fences with James Earl Jones, and then the revival with Denzel Washington. And when you watch the clip from the 70s when Fences was originally played, and they're having a scene, there is silence during this scene. And when they are viewing the exact same scene from this. This is probably about 7 or 8 years ago when Denzel did it. There's laughter at different parts of the scene, and it's because the tourist audience, they're not the theater audience. They don't get it. They don't get what's going on.
Right.
They're getting something entirely different from this. That not which is not exactly what it is.
Right, and that's especially true when you put, like, famous people in these plays.
Yeah.
Because people are there to see movie stars. They're not necessarily there to see the play. I saw Robin Williams do Bengal Tiger at the Baghdad Zoo, which is a great, like, abstract play. And it's this really dark, kind of weird play that, like, people who thought they were there to see, you know, Mork, or what was it?
Yeah.
We're like thrown by it. Same thing. What else? Like famous people in these roles.
Well, I saw Denzel Washington with
Iceman Cometh.
Iceman Cometh. And you know, I went on a date a couple months after I saw that, and we were talking about Broadway, and she was into the Broadway world, and we were talking about shows we had seen recently. And I said, oh, yeah, you know, I went to see Denzel in Iceman Cometh. And she was like, well, did you see that because you were interested in the play or because you wanted to see Denzel? And, of course, Iceman Cometh is a four-hour show. Obviously, I had no interest in seeing a four-hour show. But, yes, I wanted to see it because to be in a live room with a very quality actor like Mr. Washington – yes, I wanted to see the play because Denzel Washington was in it.
For sure.
Would I have seen Iceman Cometh if no one I knew was in it? Probably no. In fact, yeah, no, I would not see it. It's a four-hour show. But the fact is, I got to see one of the greatest living actors, probably my favorite actor, live. And he was fantastic in it. And yes, he's a celebrity, but he is also an actor. And so...
No, but and you so are the kind of person I didn't who would see have that girl appreciation again. For the play itself as well, right? Now, maybe you wouldn't have gone to see it if it not for been, you know, to get to see one of your favorite actors, which is fine. But like,
I mean, it was very hard to understand that.
Well, it is a lot. I mean, that one, like, yeah, I mean, the all of Eugene O'Neill's stuff is like, it's a task. I mean, sitting through one of those is a task. You know, Mamet said that he owes part of his career to Eugene O'Neill because as a student he would have to go and see Eugene O'Neill plays, and those were the only chances he ever got to sleep.
Right,
was
yeah,
during
yeah,
the Eugene
exactly,
O'Neill
yeah.
plays.
I mean, yeah. I mean, 4 hours, two intermissions. Having said that, we talked about Death of a Salesman earlier. Death of a Salesman is a great play, with or without PSH, Pilgrim Hoffman.
No, but that was, his performance in that play is the best piece of acting I've ever seen on stage or on film. And that play, that role of Willie Loman brings that out in people. Like a friend of ours was saying, now, the best performance I've ever seen was Brian Dennehy in Death of a Salesman, right? Like that play, that's such a rich role that it creates the potential for that.
Yeah, there's a thing where, of course, and I alluded to it earlier, where when you see celebrities in a Broadway play, you're thinking, well, that's obviously a draw to get people to go see it or charge a lot of money to see that particular play. But you also forget that these people are actors. And also, if someone like a Denzel or an Al Pacino or a Philip Seymour Hoffman is doing a Broadway show, it's because they're good quality actors, because honestly, film is different from theater. It takes a certain type of actor to be able to do Broadway. And a lot of actors today have done film, done a little bit of theater, got famous because of film, and they don't really see themselves as a real actors unless they make that pilgrimage to Broadway, unless they do Broadway. They have to do it for themselves because it's a challenge.
Yeah, I mean, Philip Seymour Hoffman used to do a play a year. He had a theater company, Labyrinth Theater Company, which I believe was affiliated with the Public somehow. But he would either direct or act in one play per year for that reason, because he just needed to work that muscle. And, you know, you actually get to act when you do work for the stage. Like, you know, a lot of movie stars, yeah, you're on a movie set for 14 hours a day. Maybe you do 30 minutes of acting that day, you know, because it's a lot of sitting and waiting around. But anyway, I think we got to wrap up. Any final thoughts?
Yeah. I would say, the Hamilton was The reason why we talked about it, it's a great show. It was a great. It's not just a guy with a camera filming the show. Obviously, they go in. They record it a few different times so they can go in and they can get close-ups and stuff like that. I think more Broadway shows actually should be doing this for people who can't afford Broadway. But it's a great musical. It's a great soundtrack. Good history lesson. Very interesting. And because I know that Congress always listens to the Dissident Film Club, just a reminder to extend the pandemic unemployment insurance when it runs out at the end of this month, because for all you people at home who are watching Hamilton and you watch those people on stage and you watch people in the end credits, just a reminder that all those people are unemployed right now. Everybody who worked on the show, everybody who acted in it, the crew, the people who put together the little film that we all watch, they are all unemployed right now. So, Congress, you know, do the right thing, all right?
There you go.
And I've been Justin. I'll see you next time.
Glad you got that in. Thank you guys very much for listening. Thank you for your support. Check us out on Facebook, Twitter. Follow us at dudissidents.com. And go to patreon.com/dudissidents for the same reason Justin just outlined. Unemployment is ending. We don't know when it's coming back or in what form. So thank you guys very much for listening. Thank you for your continued support. We'll see you next time.